Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we'll be talking with St. Louis School of Medicine professor Dr. Jeffrey Peipert about preventing unintended pregnancies and abortion.
I think in general, everyone would agree those are both good things.
They are. So we're looking forward to having that conversation, but we'll jump into research that matters.
About infant fussiness and mental health.
About vitamin D and whether or not it helps to ward off colds.
And we'll say whether or not we're taking it. About getting paid to quit smoking. Is it a good idea?
And about running away being common with autism. Let's actually start with that. Apparently, this is something that's a real problem for parents of children with autism, that running away, at least according to a survey of about 1,200 parents of children with autism spectrum disorder, running away is really common, almost half of them.
Yeah, this was in the journal Pediatrics, Christy, and of these 1,200 kids with autism, the parents of these kids, almost half the kids had tried to run away at least once, and about a third were missing long enough to cause concern, an average of more than 40 minutes. Has one of your children ever been missing, Christy?
I do have some patients with autism, and I heard a story recently of one of my patients, dear woman, who just a wonderful parent, so invested, and her son, you know, ran away, left the house. And according to the study, and just in this case, it's not so much that they're trying to get away from something, but they get interested in or going to somewhere that they want to go, but yet it can be very distressing and dangerous. For the child.
We had one of our children when they were very young in a mall went missing for about an hour, and how scared we were. And we had a neighbor once, Christy, that had an autistic child. We found the child in our kitchen one day. And we lived, you know, pretty far away from each other. And so we know this is a really problematic question. And I think this just highlights the fact that perhaps we need, at least I was thinking, we need to think about how we might bring to bear some technology that we currently have that could help families maybe be more aware and prevent some of these things from happening. I don't know what you're thinking.
Well, I think that there are advocacy groups and parenting groups that can help families really think about safe locks for the doors, strategies to keep children safe and inside so that we can protect them. But it certainly raises the awareness that we might come up with some better systems.
If we can track iPhones anywhere, any place, any time, certainly we can track our children when we need to ensure their safety. So we're hoping that this is a start of something that can decrease this, because that's a big public health safety issue. What about our very next research that matters, Christy?
Well, also a public health issue is smoking. And we know, and we've talked over and over again, the most important, if you smoke, the most important thing you can do for your health is to quit. But yet, cost is often a barrier that patients have or speak of as a thing that's holding them back.
So that is really a couple-fold, Christy. One, can you afford the medications that are known to double and sometimes triple quit rates? Can you pay to go see the doctor who maybe has really good counseling? Or does the state fund a quit line that has a proactive counselor that can give you the appropriate counseling? All these things improve quit rates.
Well, this solution was reported in the journal Addiction, appropriately titled, about a strategy where the Dutch government covered the cost of counseling and of medications to help smokers quit.
And so all of these things were covered. And I found what they found striking, Christy. Before they started this, when there was no reimbursement, a little less than 1,000 smokers enrolled in this and their smoking cessation programs. Once they did this one-year kind of experiment where they funded this all. Over 10,000, almost 10,000 smokers enrolled, but then they stopped it because of the funding, and it went back down to only a really a tad full of smokers.
Yeah, I mean, from over 9,000 to 323 people that had enrolled after the program had stopped, you know, a year or so later. So, you know, this is one of those things that we need to consider. Quitting smoking saves lives.
And investing in it from the government's perspective is cost effective. We talked last week, Christy, about reducing co-pays on medications could really help decrease costs and have people live healthier. This is another great example. We need to be encouraging our politicians to pay for these treatments because smokers will quit, and this is a good thing.
It absolutely is. And the next thing is vitamin D a good thing if you're trying to ward off colds? So self-disclosure, I take vitamin D, not to ward off colds, but just because I don't get any sun at all and have been low in it. So I take it, I'm supposed to take it every day.
Well, the question would be, are you going to have less colds? And this is a study that was in the Journal of the American Medical Association where they took a little over 800 adults and they gave them a monthly dose of vitamin D or not. And then they followed them out for a year to see how many colds they got.
So over the next year and a half, the people taking high doses of vitamin D,
high doses,
had an average of 3.7 colds and other like respiratory infections compared with 3.8 in the comparison group. So basically no difference between the two groups. So in at least in this study, which was in the Journal of the American Medical Association, there was no difference, no prevention from colds from taking vitamin D. May have had other benefits, but not on colds.
Yeah, and I don't think that they reported other benefits, but they would like us sometimes to think that there could be. I think the bottom line here is unless you have low vitamin D and there's some reason, because like for you, you don't want to be out in the sun and yet you don't want to have suffer the ill effects from having low vitamin D on your bones and otherwise as a supplement. There's not a lot of reasons.
Nope, not unless if you're taking it with your calcium and you're a woman over 50. I mean, there may be certain reasons why vitamin D could be good for you, but just to prevent colds, not so much.
Let's talk about our very last research that matters, Christy, about infant colic. And what can we counsel mothers and fathers and families about future implications on any mental health as the children get older?
And this is really stressful for parents. Babies who are really crying a lot and are very distressed in those early months to years, parents are concerned that this child just going to have mental health problems, are going to be all stressed out, or just is a troubled child. And it's hard to get through that time period.
So this study, which was in the journal Pediatrics, was based on a little over 3,000 adults who were born in the early 1980s, and they were followed till the age of 21. You don't see many studies like this that follow these children so far out, and they were all diagnosed with what is called colic. Those babies who cry for 3 or more hours a day, 3 or more days a week, for at least 3 weeks.
And what they did was they interviewed the parents and the children at around age 14, and then again once the children reached adulthood at 21 years of age. Fascinating that they found that the 10% of infants who had the most distress as babies were more likely to have behavior issues later in life based on the mother's perceptions.
But not based on when they interviewed the children.
The children.
I love that, Christy.
At the same age were about the same.
Mom
they didn't
says
have
got a
any
problem.
More.
Me? I don't have that
yeah,
problem.
Yeah, me? Not so much. And then when the kids were surveyed about their own behavior as adults, as age 21, they also had no more signs of trouble, no more signs of mental health problems or behavior issues than their peers. So all this, I think, well, it's fascinating that the mothers notice that more so than the children and adults themselves.
But long term, the bottom line here is that children with or without colic, they seem to probably turn out most of them just fine.
Just fine.
Probably not in, related to the colic. You can't blame the colic.
No, but I think it's really reassuring news.
Yes.
I mean, this research followed them for a long time, and we can reassure parents.
It's going to be okay.
It's hard.
Part of the time, but it's going to be okay.
That concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, Adam and I will be talking with Dr. Jeffrey Peipert about preventing unintended pregnancies and abortion. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with a professor in the St. Louis School of Medicine, Dr. Jeffrey Peipert, about a recent article that received national and international attention about preventing unintended pregnancies and abortion. Thank you so much for joining us today on Your Health, Dr. Peipert.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Peipert, I know Adam and I agree, and many of us agree that preventing unintended, unplanned pregnancies is a good thing. How is it that you became passionate about this as an area of focus for your research that led to the study?
Oh, great question. I think it was early in my days in medical school where I did a summer program in human sexuality and family planning that I was really fascinated by the topic. There are many public health issues around unintended pregnancies and the effect they can have on women, men, families, our entire country is enormous. So I realized early in my training that I was passionate about women's health, about prevention, and about family planning.
When we're talking about unintended pregnancies, help us understand the wide range of patient or person that may find themselves in an unintended pregnancy.
Yes, there is quite a range. We typically think it's a young person, someone who's not adequately protecting themselves, but actually it can happen to anyone. Interestingly, unintended pregnancies can happen later in our reproductive years or very early in our reproductive years or right in the middle. So anyone can have an unintended pregnancy.
You know, it makes me think on both of those spectrums of you know, a family member who in their late 40s had 2 children after getting remarried. And it also makes me think about a young teenage male age 15 that I was recently seeing that I started talking about this, and he said, well, I'm not sexually active. Why should I worry about this? Help us understand how you approach that range there.
It is an interesting range. In fact, just a quick vignette, I got a call about a week and a half ago from a gentleman in his 40s who mentioned his wife is now pregnant in an unexpected way with an unintended pregnancy and was seeking counseling of what their options are. That's just one example of sometimes in our later reproductive years, we assume that, oh, that's not an issue anymore. We don't have to worry about that, but sure enough, it is. And another extreme is just today I received a call from my teenage daughter telling me about a young friend of hers who had unexpected intercourse, did not have any protection at all, and was asking me about emergency contraception. And so it can happen whether you're 17, 41, no matter what age.
And the reality is that it would seem everyone would agree that preventing people from becoming pregnant who didn't want to become pregnant, in general, that's something we should all agree on. Correct or not correct?
Absolutely. You know, I think in the United States, we tend to bury our heads in the sand a little bit when it comes to sexuality, and especially with our young people. We fear that if we talk about it, that they'll just go out and have sex and be promiscuous. But actually, I think the opposite is true. I think young people want to be informed, and we need to help them prevent unintended pregnancy. Well, I think we should assume that they will become sexually active at some point. We should help them understand the methods of prevention.
I was also struck in your article to read about the survey of family growth between 2006 and 2008 in our country, that 49% of all pregnancies were reported to be unintended, and of those, about 30% were mistimed, 19 were unwanted, and 43% ended in abortion. And so it sounds like your work has really been to try to make headway in preventing abortion, teen pregnancy, and unplanned pregnancies.
Yes, it's a very high rate among developed countries to have almost half of pregnancies be unintended. And I think a lot of that has to do with access to contraception. Free contraception is so important because so many women, some of the highest risk women for unintended pregnancies, cannot afford current and effective methods of contraception.
We're talking with Dr. Jeffrey Peipert, St. Louis School of Medicine, about his article on preventing unintended pregnancies and abortion. And Dr. Peipert, set the stage then for why you maybe did this. Help us understand how you went about doing this research. And when we talk about various forms of contraception, help us understand what that means as well.
Sure. If I can correct one thing, Adam, it's that I'm at Washington University School of Medicine, and the reason I'm making this important distinction is that St. Louis University is a Jesuit institution here in St. Louis, and they probably would not want to be affiliated with my research in the same way.
Well, we'll come back to that, and I appreciate that correction, because there is a political dimension to this that we can't ignore. So we'll come back to that, and thank you for correcting that as well.
Sure. When we think about contraceptive methods, for many, many years, including during my training, it was a time where when a young woman came in for contraception, we had a knee-jerk reaction of giving a sample of birth control pills and a prescription for pills. And I think contraception is changing now in the U.S. We're learning that there are different methods available to women. We have vaginal rings, we have shots, we have patches. But the most promising contraceptive methods are really what I call and what many call the long-acting reversible contraceptive methods, or LARC, L-A-R-C. LARC methods include the implant, subdermal implant, and the two intrauterine devices. These methods are far more effective than the birth control pill, the patch, or the ring. And we believe that these should be the first-line methods, the first thing that clinicians offer to patients. These methods are 20-fold more effective than the pills, patches.
They're more effective because you don't have to remember something every day?
It sounds simple, but it's actually just that simple. I mean, when you think about taking a medication every day, it just sounds easy, but it's not. And missing a pill at key times in a woman's cycle, or forgetting to put the patch on, or forgetting to put the ring in at the right time, can really cause an unintended pregnancy. So having a device that you can forget about it, we call them forgettable methods. You put them in place, and you don't have to worry about it.
But one of the problems is that these are not inexpensive. These can be costly, right? So that's part of the whole premise of your research.
Absolutely. These are more costly methods up front, but they're much less costly over the long term. The implant and the IUD are among the most cost-effective methods because they're good for so long. The hormonal IUD is good for 5 years, the copper IUD for 10 years, and actually we're doing some research now and others have shown that these methods may be good for longer than that.
So what did you actually, help us understand the design of what you did and what you expected to find.
Sure. I was actually contacted by an anonymous foundation, which, due to our publications, is no longer anonymous, the Susan Thompson Buffett Foundation. And they asked us to design a study to promote the use of the most effective methods of contraception. And when I thought about how to do this study, I thought, I want to provide all methods of contraception free of charge, but I want to encourage women by telling them these methods, the IUD and the implant, are the most effective methods, and then let them choose among all methods, but let them know up front, the first thing we told every patient was the IUD and the implant are the most effective methods. And then we would counsel about all other methods.
And you were offering this and including people in your study who were either already sexually active or planning to be sexually active in the near future and at risk for an unplanned pregnancy. Is that the group?
That's absolutely right.
So this wasn't just any teenager who walked in. It was people who were at risk.
Absolutely, yes. In fact, it's true for almost any study of contraceptive methods. Your target population, the people you're interested in, are the people who are at risk.
And some of these were people who had had an abortion previously.
Yes, many of our patients had had a previous unintended pregnancy. And in fact, we recruited specifically at two fairly local abortion centers because we knew that these women had an unintended pregnancy in the past and were motivated, hopefully, to prevent a future unintended pregnancy.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break. But when we return, we're going to continue talking with Dr. Jeffrey Peipert about preventing unintended pregnancies and hearing what you found and then what that experience has been like and what's going to happen perhaps with your work. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, please continue joining us on Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're Thank listening you. To Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Washington University professor Dr. Jeffrey Peipert about preventing unintended pregnancies and abortion. And before the break, you were sharing with us some of the approach you took with your study to target all women ages 14 to 45 years old who were already sexually active or at risk for unintended pregnancies and offering them free contraception. Tell us a little bit more about the approach to the study or the methods.
Sure, Christy. When we started the study, our goals were to promote the most effective method, to increase the use of the IUD and the implant. And at baseline, before we started, they were only being used, these methods were only being used by maybe 1 or 2% of women in various clinics. Our goal was to get it to above 10%. We wanted to see if we could reduce unintended pregnancies by promoting the most effective methods, providing them free of charge, wiping out barriers to their use by inserting them in as many women as would like them. Interestingly, when we counseled women that these methods were the most effective, 75% of women chose the long-acting reversible method, the IUDs and implants.
In and of itself, that's an important finding for you, isn't it?
Yes, and in fact, we never expected that number to be that high. We expected 10, 15, 20% of women would choose the methods, never 75%.
And this, a wide range of people, did the young people in your study, did they need any particular permission from their parents, or by way of being sexually active, they could make that decision for themselves?
Well, interestingly, when we started the study, we started age 18 and older because it's a research project.
Yes.
But then we had parents, mothers, fathers bringing in their sons, their daughters for this project to say, could they be in this project? They need contraception. Hmm. So we had to lower the age limit to age 14. So, yes, we had to get parents' permission to be in this study, but many, many parents were very willing to have their child in the study.
And then tell us what you found out about preventing unintended pregnancies and how did you know these results were true?
Well, what we did was we provided methods free of charge. we watched to see how many women chose the IUDs and the implants. Then we followed women over time for 2 to 3 years. We then also followed population measures, such as abortion rates, repeat abortion rates, and teen birth. These were things we could measure in the population. And we looked at these rates specifically in our group. And what we found was the rate of teen birth abortion was far below national averages. So, for example, the rate of teen birth in the U.S. is 34 per thousand. The rate of teen birth in the choice group was 6 per thousand. The abortion rate in the United States is about 20 per thousand in reproductive age women. In our study, it was between 4 and 8 per thousand.
Dramatically different, dramatically lower.
Right. And it's interesting, when you ask the question, how do you know it's true? All we can say is these are the rates in our population. These are the national or the regional rates. You draw your own conclusions. But we believe that because 75% of this group was using the most effective methods, which keep in mind, it's very hard to make an error. You can forget about them. They're in place. They work very well. That when you have a large number of women using these methods, we don't see many unintended pregnancies. It makes sense.
One question, there was recently data coming out about some headway with teen births in our country going down, but they noticed a real disparity among different ethnic and racial backgrounds. Were you able to look at that or see any differences in choices in your study?
That is interesting, and the teen birth rate in the U.S. has dramatically dropped over the last 20 or 30 years, I believe, down about 40%, which is great, to get us to that rate of 34 per thousand. And it's interesting that there are high-risk groups, high-risk for unintended pregnancies. For example, African-Americans are at higher risk for unintended pregnancies, and a lot of that has to do with access issues, being able to get to a clinic and getting these methods. We had a very low rate of unintended pregnancies among all ethnic groups, all racial groups. And it's because so many of our participants, regardless of race or ethnicity, were using these long-acting methods.
We're talking with Dr. Jeffrey Piper from Washington University about his national article about preventing unintended pregnancies. And Dr. Piper, I guess this seems pretty strong and convincing that this should be part of the dialogue of healthcare reform. Help us understand, is it? And is this part of where we're going to be heading, because it will dramatically reduce unintended pregnancies? And then has there been a political response to this research?
Well, absolutely, there's been a political response. And yes, it should be a part of healthcare reform. We believe that women's health issues were very much front and center in this past election. And there was a clear contrast in the candidates about their approach to. It is politicized, which I think is a shame, because I think it's something like 99% of women in the U.S. use contraception at some point in their lives. So given that statistic, and that for most of a woman's reproductive life, she is trying to avoid pregnancy, I would think that we should have easy access to contraceptive methods and the most effective ones for all women. To me, it's not a matter of politics, it's a matter of public health. Women's health and family. And this is a preventable situation. Family planning saves healthcare dollars. So, in my view, in many experts' views, if we can prevent unintended pregnancy, we may be able to save a significant amount of healthcare dollars. It's estimated that unintended pregnancies cost about $11 billion annually in the U.S.
And there are other health and wellness impacts of unintended pregnancy. So as you think about this and its application throughout a woman's life, what are the other impacts that can come from preventing an unplanned pregnancy?
Well, there are many. I'll just mention a few. One is that unintended pregnancies are higher risk pregnancies. We know they have higher low birth weight, higher preterm birth or being born before the fetus is fully developed. There are conflicts that occur in the relationship due to unintended pregnancy, resulting oftentimes in domestic violence. And especially in a young teen's life, your ability to complete your educational goals and reach a career that you'd like are disturbed by an unintended pregnancy. So a woman cannot finish her education or have the career she would like. So the ramifications of an unintended pregnancy are enormous in society.
And then help us understand, I guess, in our closing minute here about where do you go from here? I mean, because there is this question, is long-acting contraceptive made free for every woman in the United States who either is at risk or seeking to avoid an unintended pregnancy? Is that the next step or what?
Yes, I think that is an important next step. In many other countries in the world where contraception is freely accessible and low cost or free, there are much lower rates of unintended pregnancy. So, yes, from here, we believe that access issues need to be addressed. Cost issues need to be addressed. Clinicians and patients need to be educated about the most effective method. I use the analogy that if we had a drug for cancer that was 20-fold better than the next drug, would you use the B drug as opposed to the highly effective drug? You'd always use the most effective drug. So I'm not saying that all women will want or have these long-acting methods, but you can see from our study that a majority are willing to try them and use them, and they have very high continuation and satisfaction rates. So we believe the next step is make these methods, all methods, more accessible to all women. That will then reduce unintended pregnancy, the need for abortion.
Well, the fact that you're, in your study you found such a decrease in abortion, a decrease in repeat abortion, and a decrease in teen birth is, I mean, it's astounding, and we appreciate the work that you're doing and your willingness to take the time to share it with us and try to help us move forward with the next steps.
Great. Thank you for having me.
We've been talking with Dr. Jeffrey Peipert, Washington University School of Medicine. Thank you for sharing your work with our audience.
My pleasure.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health, Christy. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to talk about our listeners' health questions and concerns.
And if you are a listener out there with a question or a comment that you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, send them to yourhealth@unc.edu. And now we've got a few questions for our listeners. What do we have today, Adam?
Well, we have a very interesting question about pancreatitis and the causes.
A question about taking testosterone.
And a question about sleep apnea and the testing for it.
And a little bit about marijuana and use for health.
Well, let's listen to our very first House Call question today.
My mother had pancreatitis recently. The doctor said it came from her gallbladder, but she had an x-ray and had no gallstones. She doesn't drink, but she does have diabetes. What do you think, as it was so painful and she wants to prevent another episode?
Pancreatitis, that is something that can be very, very painful. And I think you're wise to be thoughtful about trying to find out what caused it so that you can try to prevent it for your mother.
And we generally see most cases of pancreatitis coming from either gallstones, and called gallstone pancreatitis. That gallstone kind of slips through the gallbladder and it passes into the duodenum and the stomach, and it kind of goes right by the pancreas and irritates it. Or we see it due to alcoholic pancreatitis.
And gallstones and alcohol are the vast majority of the causes of the cases for pancreatitis. But it can also be related to smoking, to very, very high triglycerides, which are a part of your cholesterol.
Sometimes medications can even cause it. But in your particular case, I think they're probably maybe assuming it came from the gallbladder because maybe they didn't see any other risk factors and you haven't said that you're a drinker. So maybe they were assuming that, and that sometimes happened. If you had a gallstone, it may have passed.
But I do think it's worth going back through with the doctor a good story of the history and make sure that the doctor's been very thoughtful about what are all the things that could cause it. If it's a medicine, then that would be something that, you know, she could change that medicine that wouldn't perhaps prompt that. And in some cases, if there's no explanation, which apparently in 20 or 30% of the cases, we don't figure it out, you might have the doctor really check and think about, could it be something else like a cancer?
So
very unlikely, but still.
And this is a tough situation. It is painful. Maybe our answer is not fully reassuring, but we're glad that she's better because that's a really tough diagnosis sometimes and really serious. And good luck, and thank you for sharing that with our listeners. Let's listen to our very next house call, Christy.
I've been using testosterone for years. It makes me feel better overall. My primary care doctor said, however, he would no longer give me a prescription because of my high blood pressure and some effects on my blood cells. Should I get another primary care physician or should I see a urologist?
So I'll be interested in what you think about this, Adam. But, you know, my experience with testosterone is that it's really tough because a lot of men have trouble with libido and low mood and energy, and that can be related to having a low testosterone. But sometimes, even with taking supplementation, it's unclear if it makes a big difference.
And unfortunately, the research is pretty clear that the great majority of men who are taking testosterone don't have low blood levels of testosterone. And unless you really have a low blood level of testosterone, there is no evidence other than some people saying it. And I'm not discounting that, but there's no real medical evidence. So whether insurance companies should pay for it and whether doctors should prescribe it, particularly because there are side effects.
There really can be side effects to taking this medicine. I mean, a lot of my patients mostly just complain that it's a pain to wipe it on their arms, you know, that many times, and it's unclear if it's making a difference. But there can be side effects. So you don't just want to take a medicine if you don't have if you don't have low testosterone or a real reason to try it.
And the complications include having thickened blood cells, red blood cells, which can cause all kinds of problems, including strokes and heart attacks, to having acne-like skin and abnormal altered cholesterol lipid profile.
Sleep apnea is another
one. Sleep apnea. And so the question is, should you get a new primary care physician? Well, I would say no. If you like your primary care doctor, I would stick with it. It's hard enough to find doctors and patients who really have that great relationship. And if you have a great relationship, maybe respect the doctor and ask the doctor to explain a little bit more clearly. I don't know. I would tend to side on the doctor on this one, Christy.
Yeah, I would agree. And I do think it's a conversation so you both understand and can come to an agreement.
And should you see a urologist? Well, I think the urologist will probably apply most of the same standards. I mean, you certainly can do injections of testosterone, but those are no safer, no better. Again, tough situation, but thank you for your question. Let's listen to our very next house call.
I have high blood pressure and am overweight, maybe even obese. My doctor said I should get a sleep apnea test, but I feel great. Is this reasonable or is it simply another expensive test?
What do you think, Christy?
Well, I think the fact that you feel great is key, and I'd really want to find out more about when you say you feel great, about specifically, are you having any of the symptoms of sleep apnea, which can be having snoring or stopping breathing during the day, really profound daytime sleepiness where you feel like you were in bed for a long time, but you still feel really, really tired, along with other things like falling asleep during the day when you didn't intend to or feeling like you need to nap. But sleep apnea can be dangerous to your health. It can raise your blood pressure, and you actually stop breathing in the night.
And even if you feel good, you might actually still have the sleep apnea. So I think mm-hmm. your doctor's right on this one. I mean, there are a lot of things that you feel good that you don't know that you have, like high blood pressure, sometimes even early diabetes, for which most people believe, yeah, I should get those treated. So why not here? Is it the cost of the study and the time and inconvenience that's stopping you? I think that's the conversation that needs to occur here, Christy.
Well, and I think you should understand more fully why your doctor thinks you should get this test. Sleep apnea is very, very closely related with being overweight or obese. And so
and
high blood pressure. And losing weight would be a good step to trying to help that if you do have it. But the conversation, really understanding why your doctor is recommending it, I think is the key step here.
Yep. But we applaud your doctor for recognizing it, because not all of us, maybe even Christy and I, we may not always recognize that. So good doctor, stay with them.
Let's hear our next house call question.
My mother has been using marijuana for a painful nerve condition. It seems to cause her less side effects than the Neurontin her doctors prescribed and seems to help. What are your thoughts?
Wow, we're not going to be able to do this justice in just a couple minutes, but I'll tell you that marijuana has been used, and there is an actual prescription for
synthetic marijuana.
Exactly. It's called Marinol is the trade name.
Synthetic
Dronabinol.
THC. And though many who use marijuana will say anecdotally that it's not the same to take a pill than it is and to inhale it form. And we know that in a lot of drugs, when you inhale a drug, you get blood levels much
that
higher
might be
and
different.
Quicker sometimes. So we certainly understand that.
But the treatment for the medication that can be prescribed related to marijuana is for, you know, profound nausea, vomiting, or for stimulating hunger in patients who really with profound cancer or with advanced HIV or AIDS, where eating is a real problem, and that can be sort of a last effort of trying to stimulate the appetite. It's not traditionally used for nerve conditions, but could be helpful with pain. In this case, it doesn't sound like your doctor's prescribing it, that it's a matter of your mom smoking the marijuana at home.
And I don't think either Christy or I want to lose our licenses for recommending medical marijuana over or marijuana over the show. This isn't medical marijuana necessarily, and yet lots of states are looking at this. There's a lot of interest in understanding this. You know, it's awful that you're having side effects, your mother, from the Neurontin and has a painful condition. We would encourage you to have a confidential conversation mm-hmm. with your doctor, because, you know, sometimes we do have to listen, really listen to what our patients are saying. And, you know, we may not recommend it, but whether we discourage it in some circumstances is an issue between you and your doctor.
I would agree. I think the open communication, that's been a theme throughout these house calls today. The open communication with your doctor is really important. There may be other medications that that are legal that could help for treatment
that wouldn't put you at risk in that way. Yeah. Well, that'll conclude our house calls, and we want to thank you for joining us on Your Health. Please feel free to send us questions at yourhealth@unc.edu or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. We'd like to thank the staff of WCHL and the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Jeffrey Piper. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.